You're listening to Food Integrity Now with your host, Carol Grabe. Hello and welcome to Food Integrity Now. I'm Carol Grabe. I'm your host today. At Food Integrity Now, we envision a world without GMOs, a thriving world where our food is safe for our children and our grandchildren. If you share this vision, go to our website and join us. Or if you'd like to sponsor a show or advertise with us, send us an email to info@foodintegritynow.org. We also have a donate button on our main page if you'd like to help in that way. And we really appreciate your support. Our show today is brought to you in part by Biolumina Spirulina. Hi, it's Carol again. I don't endorse many products, but Biolumina Spirulina is one product that I highly endorse. Spirulina is called a superfood because its nutrient content is more potent than any other food. It has been proven that you could actually live on this product. Biolumina Spirulina is the premium spirulina. It contains more phycocyanin than any other spirulina. Phycocyanin is a powerful antioxidant. It is grown cleanly without any synthetics, GMOs, and pesticide, and it's also a proven immune booster and is a radiation protectant and cleanser. I've been taking this product for over a year, and I feel like it's one of the finest whole food supplements on the market. To find out more about Biolumina, go to www.newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. Once again, that's www.newphoenixrising.com/beingwell. Or just go to the show page and click on the link. You're going to really love this product. My guest today is Nora Gedgaudas. Nora is one of the world's leading experts on Paleolithic nutrition, and she's also the author of the international best-selling book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and Longer Life. She's also a board-certified holistic nutritionist through the National Association of Nutritional Professionals and is recognized by the Nutritional Therapy Association as a certified nutritional therapist. Nora, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Carol. I'm grateful that you asked me to come on.
Well, it's a subject that's very interesting to me, and I think our listeners can learn a lot. I certainly enjoyed your book. And before we get started, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about you and how you got interested in nutritional science and why you wrote the book, Primal Mind, Primal Body?
Well, I'm a clinical neurofeedback practitioner and also a board-certified nutritional in holistic nutrition and also nutritional therapist. And I've been at this a really, really long time. My interest in nutrition spans more than actually in excess of 35 years now. It's been a very long time that I've been passionate about the subject in general, but it's only been in more recent years that I've gotten the foundational grounding of looking at diet and health from a more evolutionary based perspective, which I think has to be the essential starting place, because otherwise it's too easy to get lost in minutia and it's too easy to get lost in misinformation and disinformation and all sorts of mixed agendas. So I spent some time in the high Arctic, living actually with wild wolves near the North Pole. And,
oh, really? You lived with wolves? Tell us a little bit more about that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Four-legged variety. Yeah. I had been doing some work in wildlife science and behavioral research and was in the company of arguably the world's foremost scientific expert on the wolf. His name was Dr. L. David Meach. And he's done a lot of the early pioneering research, with wolves and has studied them on every continent in the world and in all their habitats. And he happened to find this family of wolves on Ellesmere Island, which is the northernmost landmass before the northern polar ice cap. And, um, And ever since 1986, he's been going up every single summer to live with this same family, which, of course, it changes from year to year. But this is an area of the world that's so remote that the wolves have never really ostensibly never been hunted. The closest human village from this location that we were at is about 350 miles to the south of us. So it was truly pristine and remote. And the wolves just simply viewed us with some combination of curiosity and indifference, which I found actually fascinating all by itself. We just basically were part of the family for the entire summer, and followed them on their hunts and watched them while they slept, and sometimes were left to babysit the pups when they went off on hunts we couldn't follow on. And it was a fairly industrial strength religious experience, but it's something that put me in touch with what it meant to live on the land in a fairly austere way, and contemplating what it must have been like during the throes of the last ice age, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, where, you know, the conditions were, you know, relatively harsh and unforgiving. And, you know, Arctic summer isn't that terrible. But you still have permafrost, and you have, very limited plant life growing that's best used by the ruminants that live there, the muskoxen and the peary caribou. And, humans would have been relegated to, not a lot more than eating them and a couple other of the land animals that existed there, that and whatever they were able to pull out of the sea. You know, walrus and seal and things like that, whale blubber. And I found myself craving fat constantly. And I had come, you know, where I had come from, I, at that time in my life, this was back in 1991, I was pretty, my diet was mostly vegetables probably at that time. And although I wasn't a vegetarian, I was doing a lot of, you know, trying to really put a lot of emphasis on plant foods. And when I got to Ellesmere, the last thing I wanted or thought about even was plant foods. I craved, meat and fat. And I started realizing that that's probably what the people that lived there ate. And isn't that supposed to be bad for us? And yet they lived for millennia and, you know, were ostensibly healthy as Aboriginal populations until we started messing with them with our, you know, agendas and our compromised food supply. And what's happened to them since then has been nothing short of completely tragic and genocidal. But, and then, you know, so there was a lot that I had to think about in the back of my mind. And sometimes not so far to the back of my mind while I was there over that summer. And then I got back and eventually ran into the work of Weston Price. And that started to make a lot more sense to me. And what that did was triggered an interest for me in looking at diet and health from our earliest evolutionary perspective. Looking at traditional diets just didn't go far back enough for me. To me, it seemed logical that... And I don't know why it hadn't seemed logical prior to that whatever the selective pressures were that shaped us, that shaped our, you know, our, well, whatever kinds of conditions there would have been that we would have been subjected to, whatever kinds of foods that would have generally been available all the way up until the agricultural revolution, which was relatively recent, certainly from a genetic standpoint, extremely recent. And whatever other conditions would have served to shape our physiological makeup and certainly would have shaped our nutritional requirements. And so to me, that had to be a starting place in determining what the optimal human diet was. And the rest from there was just shaping and molding around those foundational principles. And the whole idea of, the paleo diet, which is where I started with all of this about, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago now, has really kind of morphed into a modified approach to that, because to me, it has to be modified for a couple of reasons. One is that We're not living in that time anymore. And what we're facing as a species is far more challenging than anything that our ancient ancestors ever knew. We still have the same foundational requirements. We still have a foundational need for animal source foods, which made up really the bulk of our diet for a good portion of our evolutionary history. However, we need to try to address the world that we live in now and attempt to apply these principles in a way that makes sense for the conditions that we live in. And then the other part to that too is looking at things like human longevity research and whatever have you, so that you can further modify those principles to sort of fine tune them, if you will, in a way that gets sort of beyond Mother Nature's plan, which isn't necessarily, Mother Nature isn't necessarily concerned with keeping us around forever. You know, she wants us to be healthy enough, long enough to be able to reproduce. And then, you know, she sort of moves on and we get left behind and start to deteriorate. So figuring out where those loopholes are in our natural design to better optimize those principles in a way that helps us live longer in a more disease, in other words, in a more disease-free fashion.
Right, and disease-free, that has to be such a complex subject right now because...
It's a term.
Yes, because of the increase in diabetes and heart disease and cancer and its relation to food has got to be has really needs to be studied thoroughly,
right.
And I think it is. Well, there are several topics I'd like to cover with you today, and let's start out with grains. The USDA puts grains at the bottom of the food pyramid and tells us that it's the most important component of a healthy diet. Can you share with us what grains do in our body?
Well, the fact is that grains are actually a relatively new food to us as a species. We've only been consuming, well, agricultural revolution occurred roughly 10,000 years ago, and that was in ancient Sumeria, Mesopotamia. But many places in Europe really didn't start to adopt agriculture in a widespread way until a couple of thousand years ago. And there are certain native populations that haven't even been dabbling in agriculture for more than a couple hundred years. And so it takes anywhere from 40 to 100,000 years for our genetics to really catch up to a major change and fully adapt to a major change. We're nowhere near there. And the fact of the matter is that as time goes on, we're actually becoming less adapted to these foods and not more so. When you consider that the base of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's food pyramid, you know, is 6 to 11 servings of grains a day, you have to realize that there's going to be some bias there, that the what was used to make a determination of what the optimal human diet is had nothing really to do with what was healthiest for humans based on the available research or even based on our physiological makeup. It was based on basically politics and economics and nothing more. And there's no human people group in the history of the entire human species that has ever eaten a diet remotely resembling what that USDA food pyramid suggests is optimal. And yet that is the gold standard in terms of government guidelines where school lunches are supplied. And, you know, if you really want to know what eating according to the USDA food pyramid is going to do for you, then go to a native reservation and see what you find there. Because what you have there, basically, these people, because of the government supposedly attempting, you know, reparations, and which I find kind of, you know, laughable, and you know, trucking, you know, food based on government guidelines into these impoverished places, you basically are going to see the highest rates in the world of diabetes and heart disease and cancers and alcoholism and obesity and every manner of modern disease that our ancestors, you know, and their ancestors just simply never knew anything about. And so, consider this, you know, they use grains to fatten up cattle in feedlots. And I think that we could probably look at it the same way. You know, it's not a food pyramid, it's a feedlot pyramid, you know, to borrow Michael Eads. And I think that's the most accurate way to see it. There is no such thing anywhere in the world as a person walking around with a grain deficiency. No one has any requirement whatsoever. Grains contain they're an inferior food source to the foods we evolved eating as hunter-gatherers. And they contain a lot of what are called anti-nutrients that can serve to compromise us in multiple ways. The fibers in grains are also, can also be termed, and legumes, by the way, too, phytic acid, will bind and make minerals unavailable to you. Even if minerals exist in the grain, they're not really available to you biologically. You're not really able to digest and absorb them because of the presence of these phytates that bind them and make them unavailable to you. And if you eat enough of them, they may even draw them out of your own body. The worst of offender in that regard is actually soybeans. They have the worst levels of phytic acid. But there are also things like trypsin inhibitors, things that impair your ability to digest and absorb protein over time. And again, legumes are the worst offenders in that regard, but grains contain certain amounts of those things too. Grains also contain proteins that, until we adopted agricultural practices, we never ate before in our long evolutionary history, at least in any significant way. Obviously, we knew enough to domesticate grains and start cultivating them because we had apparently found them here and there and had eaten them. I think what happened was because grains also contain morphine-like compounds that are quite addictive for some, I think we became addicted to them as a food source and went from a comparatively easier, in some respects, hunter-gatherer lifestyle, to one that where we were spending eight, you know, or more hours a day engaged in backbreaking labor in the fields to produce a food substance that was vastly inferior and that compromised us. And a good anthropologist can take a look at whatever kind of human remains they come across, and they can tell you whether that's a pre-agricultural or post-agricultural a skeleton, just simply based on the health of that skeleton and the health of, you know, the teeth and the bones and the appearance of the stature and all of that.
Which is what Dr. Weston A. Price did in his studies, right? He studied the teeth. Of our ancestors.
Well, the healthiest teeth he ever found were among the Inuit, who are, for all intents and purposes, were nearly 100% carnivorous culture. But, you know, you have to realize that we've actually spent, you know, our evolutionary history began, you know, roughly, you know, well, the first evidence of meat eating among hominids was, in fact, our earliest human ancestor that, according to anthropologists, was a representative of A. afarensis they named her Lucy, and they recently found that she actually showed evidence of tool making, and that the tools of which were used to break open bone marrow and brain casings to get at fat and to butcher meat. And so she was 3.36 million years old. And that's where it started. They know that at least by 2 million years ago, meat was already a staple part of our diet. It wasn't just something we did every once in a while, although nearly all apes, in other words, nearly all of our you know, primate ancestors do eat some meat. But meat became much more important to us as time went on. And by a couple million years ago, that was a major staple in our diets. And you can look at the work of happening at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. A man by the name of Professor Michael Richards now has looked at thousands of samples, you know, of at least hundreds of human remains from that go way, way, way back, and found that we were actually higher level carnivores through the better part of our evolutionary history than our wolves, bears, or foxes, and other carnivores that we evolved alongside.
Wow, that's interesting.
Partly because we had the technology, I think, to bring down the big megafauna, which existed right up until the end of the last ice age. And cataclysmic changes at that time that occurred rather abruptly were those that they just couldn't, you know, they weren't able to survive. We would have, you know, if you bring down a woolly mammoth, you've got a family barbecue that lasts a few days, right?
Right.
Presumably wolves wouldn't have had the, you know, the ability to bring down prey that was that big.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have been relegated to bringing down smaller things and then divvying that up among the pack members. And I know firsthand that wolves sometimes will go days or even a week without eating. And then, you know, the pack brings something down and they all, you know, try to, you know, divvy it up as they do and try to save the best parts for the pups and all that. And so we would have been able to kind of, you know, gorge freely on whatever we were able to kill in terms of, you know, our large megafauna. And I think that's why, you know, Richards finds, the things that he does. But, we're really, there's no question that one of the things that's absolutely clear from the stable isotopic analysis that is able to look at bone collagen and accurately determine what kind of protein we were getting in our diets. And the thing that was absolutely clear is that in no sample found was there any evidence of grains being part of that dietary, you know, of that dietary makeup. And, you know, if they ate grains, it wasn't in any significant amount. And so this is for the vast majority of our evolutionary history. And it's why we have such large brains as opposed to, even other carnivores, because we, you know, we developed a largely fat and meat based diet that, that we became very efficient at procuring. And we also physiologically changed a lot from our ape ancestors and developed a way reduced, large intestine and a greatly expanded small intestine that are actually really well designed to handle what anthropologists term a high quality diet, which is primarily meat and fat. So.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of people tell me, they say, well, you know, what's the whole thing with gluten? Because
right.
Our grandparents weren't claiming they were gluten intolerant. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there are many reasons for this. Now, gluten, of course, is kind of a term used to describe a complex of proteins found in certain cereal grains. Mainly wheat, rye, and barley contain the form of gluten that we're mainly talking about here. Mm-hmm. And it's made up of literally thousands of little peptides, any one of which could be potentially immunoreactive for us. Now, I think that again, I think our ancestors had a whole lot more wiggle room for their health than we do today. One of the things that some of your listeners might be familiar with is the work of I just forgot his name, and Francis Pottinger.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, you know, the Pottinger's cats, where each generation, subsequent generation that is exposed to a compromised diet, a compromised food supply, loses some of its genetic integrity, right? The mm-hmm. genome gradually becomes increasingly compromised. Now, in Pottinger's experiments, by the 10th generation, that those cats that were eating a compromised diet couldn't even reproduce anymore. And that's really where we're going. And look how much money is getting pumped into fertility clinics. So as each subsequent generation goes by, I think we're becoming more and more vulnerable to the things in these foods that have the potential to compromise us. I think that's part of it. Some of it also has to do with we're also being subjected to increasing levels of contaminants of all manner, shape, and form in our environment, in our water, in our food supply. There's genetic modification of the food supply. There's, we have radiation exposure now. There's, EMF exposure. You know, heavy metals and pesticides and literally 100,000, industrial chemicals in use worldwide that could be potentially contaminating our water supply. And yet the best water treatment facilities in the country don't test for more than about 200 different compounds. And there are all sorts of pharmacologic compounds now that have contaminated our water supply. All kinds of things. Fluoride, just don't even get me started. And so
that's a whole nother show.
Whole other show. Yeah. and we're supposed to stand up to this while our soils are being depleted, while our, you know, clean water is no longer clean. And again, with increased genetic susceptibility. So there's that. Also, we have begun, making, changes to the grains that we consume, and they've started deamidating the wheat, which changes some of the properties of it and makes us more vulnerable to reactivity. And then finally, they're also selecting for more gluten in the grains. And so I think all of these things are sort of converging and coming together in a way that makes these things highly risky, I think, to incorporate in diet. And by the way, one of the things that's unique about gluten and why I tend to refer to it as a quote unquote gateway sensitivity, because there are a lot of different kinds of food sensitivities, as I'm sure all your listeners know. You know, why are we picking on gluten? Well, the fact is that gluten has a unique effect that, apart from the fact that it is possible to be genetically susceptible to it, and that's, you know, not just celiac disease, by the way, but gluten intolerance in general, which is increasingly recognized now officially as a true problem, at least in the field of immunology. There's no question anymore. In the field of conventional medicine, there are a lot of MDs who have not caught up with the times, because the problem being that, you know, there's no such thing as a medical immunologist. Immunologists are PhDs, they're researchers. And medical doctors, you know, may not be up on the literature and the, you know, happening in the field of immunology, but they ought to be, because right now the number three cause of morbidity and mortality as a collective whole in the entire industrialized world is autoimmune disease, right behind cancer and heart disease. And by the way, the number one cause of death in a celiac patient, which, by the way, celiac disease comprises a total of about 12% of what compromises the totality of gluten intolerance, all of which is autoimmune in nature, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Gluten intolerance is autoimmune. And only 12% of that is represented by celiac disease. And only a small percentage of that is gastrointestinally based. And the only way that medicine recognizes celiac is as a gastrointestinal condition. And that gets involved. But and so the number one cause of death in a celiac patient is actually a cardiovascular event. The number one cause of death the number two cause of death in a celiac patient is malignancy. And so there are ties into the number one and two cause of death. And by the way, there was a recent paper published that found the initiating stages of atherosclerosis to be autoimmune in nature. So this is, you know, this is, as the picture becomes better understood, autoimmunity is emerging as an enormous problem, even though it is only recognized, autoimmune disease is only recognized as being a rarity by conventional medicine because of the standards used to diagnose them, which are abysmal, to be perfectly frank. You're not diagnosable with celiac disease, for instance, until the lining of your small intestinal tract goes from looking like shag carpeting, you know, with the villi in there fully intact, to looking entirely like Berber. And it's only when you have completely lost all of your villi that you are then diagnosable with celiac. If you've only lost 60%, you're fine. Go home, have some bread. You don't have any problems here. And that's a problem.
That is a problem because I've heard people say before, well, I was tested for celiac disease and I'm fine. And,
right.
And yet they feel they have issues.
Look, 30%, only 30% of the serologic testing used to, or of the results gotten from serologic testing, conventional serologic testing, only about 30% of those results are accurate. You have 70% of the time that is basically a false negative. And there are many reasons for this. In conventional serologic testing for sensitivity to gluten, for instance, they only really look for alpha gliadin as a general rule. And alpha gliadin is only one proteome among literally thousands, but there are at least a dozen that are the most commonly reactive. And they only look at alpha gliadin because that is the one that is most commonly associated with intestinal-based celiac disease. And there's omega and delta gliadin. And if you happen to be sensitive to those, which are also associated with celiac, you're going to get a false negative if you're not sensitive to the alpha gliadin fraction. The other thing is that they typically only look at IgA immunoglobulins antibodies, and lots of people have wiped out IgA levels. And so if you don't have enough of that immunoglobulin to react with the antigen, you're going to show up, in all probability, falsely negative. The other, thing is, if 8 out of 10 celiac patients, for instance, don't have any gastrointestinal symptoms at all. In fact, according to the journal Gastroenterology, I believe it was, is either that or Neurology. I don't have the citation right in front of me, although I could dig it out if you really wanted me to. But the quote, I almost word for word from that citation was that celiac disease is primarily and at times exclusively a neurological disease affecting not only the brain and nervous system, but also cognitive and psychiatric illness. And so, the brain tends to take the biggest beating when it comes to what gluten can do to you. And only a small percentage, again, of gluten intolerance is actually celiac disease, which is characterized by a couple of genetic markers. But there are other genetic markers associated with other types of gluten intolerance. And you don't have to have a genetic marker in order to develop gluten intolerance. And so this is a highly complicated issue that is greatly oversimplified in a really ignorant way by mainstream medical people who just simply have not caught up to what is happening in the field of immunology. And when you look at the field of immunology, it is absolutely clear this is a widespread epidemic problem. And like I was saying, that one of the things that gluten does that a lot of other food sensitivities don't do is when we consume it, and by the way, whether or not you are immunologically reactive to gluten, when you consume a gluten-containing food, it stimulates the production of an enzyme called zonulin. And I'm always joking that zonulin sounds like something from a Star Trek movie. And I saw the recent one. It was awesome. But anyhow. at any rate, zonulin basically controls intestinal permeability. And so your gut, which is normally very, very carefully semi-permeable, it is very picky, and it gosh darn well better be very picky about what it allows through from your GI tract into the bloodstream. You don't want partially digested or undigested protein slipping through from your small intestine into your bloodstream, because as soon as a protein gets through that your body doesn't recognize, it mounts an immune-based attack. Now, in the short term, what that can result in is, especially with repeated ingestion, your body says, okay, this, whatever this invading thing is, we've got to tag it and be sure that we're on it every time it shows up because this is a danger. You start to develop immunologic reactions to certain foods in your diet. Now, whatever else happens to be in your diet, even if you're not reacting to the gluten may be facilitating other food sensitivities. But usually, eventually, if you eat it long enough, eventually you develop that immunologic reactivity to gluten as well. But I've seen examples of this many times because I do a fairly sophisticated level of testing, in my practice that looks at this in really great detail. There's only one lab in the world doing accurate testing in this regard. And
that's, I'm curious. Can you give us the name of that lab?
Yeah, I was just saying it. It's Cyrex Labs. CYREXLABS. So the whole immunologic thing is highly significant because, and the zonulin thing is highly significant. And by the way, if you have an overly permeable, GI tract, an overly permeable gut, in other words, a leaky gut, I promise you, you also have a leaky blood-brain barrier. This doesn't get talked about that much, but the same mechanisms control the permeability of your gut also control the permeability of that blood-brain barrier, and that is not good. Mm-hmm. And we can't afford to have our brains be subjected to whatever wants to get in there and start rattling around. And so, basically, you know, gluten is, I consider it, you know, the act of eating gluten and pretending that it's an okay thing to be, like spinning the cartridge on a loaded gun where there's one bullet in a chamber and clicking it every time you eat, because, you know, sooner or later you're bound to run into a problem.
You know what? I hear this all the time too, where people say, well, I'm mostly gluten free. I don't eat a lot of gluten.
Right. And here, that's also an unfortunate misconception. And I understand because I shared it at one time. Look, I stopped eating grains about 25 years ago or something like that. So I didn't really think I needed to worry about being quote unquote gluten free because I wasn't eating grains anyway. I wasn't eating bread or pasta or, you know, any of that junk. But if I wasn't going out and actively buying it, but it's like, well, I may, you know, if I order some calamari and it has a coating of flour on it, well, what's that going to hurt, right? Or the occasional bite of something.
Right.
You know, yeah, this condiment might have gluten in it. Well, I feel bad for those poor people with celiac disease, but I'm not one of them. I assumed I didn't have a problem with gluten, mainly because I, you know, had never really gotten tested. A lot of people don't have any clue that they have a sensitivity until they have a lab result that shows them otherwise. Same thing happened to me more recently with dairy, where I really didn't think I had an immunologic reactivity to dairy, and it turns out it's a huge problem. I'm still learning too. But the fact of the matter is that gluten intolerance is something that it's like, really, it's the equivalent of being, say, just a little bit pregnant. Either you are or you're not. If you are gluten intolerant, then you have no room for error. You can't just every once in a while have a beer and not worry about it. You can't just every once in a while have a piece of birthday cake or have, you know, that soy sauce on your, you know, fish or whatever. It's not okay. Even trace amounts are significant enough to your immune system that it can set up an inflammatory response that could last literally for potentially months. A single exposure of a trace amount. Your risk of developing. So if you are somebody who is gluten intolerant, and by the way, that is an autoimmune condition. All right. Okay. It's not just, you know, I hate the term gluten sensitivity because it sounds so benign. Oh, you know, they're just a little sensitive is all. Oh, God, no. It's a really potentially life-threatening condition. And if you have gluten intolerance of any kind and you continue to consume gluten, even in trace amounts, your odds of developing a second or third autoimmune condition are statistically, from the immunologic literature, literally 100%. And nowadays, the presence of unhealthy levels of autoimmune antibodies is a nearly ubiquitous problem in the population. That's the dirty little secret. I had lunch one day with one of the world's most respected immunologic researchers. He's a world-class immunologist by the name of Dr. Aristo Vajdani. And he founded both Immunosciences Lab and Cyrix Labs. He's probably 30 years ahead of everybody else in the field. His testing methods are just scientific method are absolutely impeccable. He has published more than 150 peer-reviewed papers.
Can you say his name again?
Aristo, A-R-I-S-T-O, Vajdani, V-O-J-D-A-N-I.
Okay.
And we were discussing some of this information over lunch, and it was completely fascinating. Of course, the whole time I'm sitting across from him, I'm thinking, you know, do you have any idea that you're like Bruce Springsteen to me? But anyway. at one point I said to him, basically, so what you're telling me is that pretty much everyone we see, or most of the people we see walking around here, you know, in the streets of LA that were, you know, there was a lot of traffic and a lot of people walking around where we were, that most of these people have some form of autoimmune condition and simply don't know it. And he says, yes, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's what shows. And when you do the immunologic testing to help ferret out what antibodies people are producing against what tissues, it is an extreme rarity not to find some inappropriate level of antibody production in a person that gets tested. And that's quite scary.
Yeah, that
you have an autoimmune disease. So what defines an autoimmune disease? Well, in medicine, let's use another example besides celiac disease. If you're producing antibodies against your own adrenal tissue, for instance, you are not diagnosable with what is called Addison's disease, which was suffered, by the way, by, you know, President John F. Kennedy. He had Addison's. He's probably the most famous Addison sufferer. But you're not diagnosable with what is called Addison's disease until a minimum, and this is the medical standard, until a minimum of 90% tissue destruction has occurred, 90. So if you have 45% tissue destruction in your adrenal tissue, you're basically fine. Even though I promise you, you will be feeling that in every part of the way you feel and function in your life.
So the diagnosis is almost too late.
Yeah. By the time you are diagnosable, there's so much tissue destruction that has occurred that there's almost nothing to be done. You know, they'll throw you on prednisone or who knows what. And yet, see, the thing about it is that there's a tremendous amount now that is understood about the mechanisms that initiate and also drive autoimmunity. That's really exciting because in some ways there's never been a better time, you know, to have an autoimmune disease if you have access to that information, because there's a tremendous amount you can do naturally to sort of mitigate the effects of the immune dysfunction and lead a relatively normal existence where you can do a lot to dampen the advance of the disease by dampening the inflammatory response and modulating your immune response so that, you know, your body, you know, you're able to manage it, you know, in many cases, able to manage it really well.
Without prescription drugs?
Yeah, well, the problem with prescription drugs, they don't treat anything.
Right.
You know, they're basically, they have almost nothing to offer you. For instance, the number one most common autoimmune disease is gluten intolerance, absolutely, worldwide. But the number two most common autoimmune disease process is autoimmune thyroid, for instance, Hashimoto's by some when it's actually diagnosed as a disease. And what a lot of people probably listening to this don't realize is that, I don't know how many people listening to this have been diagnosed with low thyroid function, for instance. Well, guess what? 80% of all low thyroid function is actually autoimmune in nature. 80%.
Wow.
And so unless you have been also tested for autoimmune antibodies, you probably have no clue about this. The odds of your doctor bothering to do that are fairly slim. Why is that? Because they basically would treat you exactly the same either way, mainly because they have nothing else to offer you, literally nothing else to offer you. So if your TSH is up, they'll prescribe some thyroid hormone to make your labs look prettier, and yet you may still be suffering every single symptom associated with that thyroid issue. Although in that instance, I'm here to tell you that if your thyroid is suffering from an autoimmune process, your primary problem isn't thyroid related, it's immune, and it needs to be addressed on that level. And nearly 100% of all Hashimoto's cases, by the way, are associated with gluten as a gluten intolerance as an absolutely major factor in that disorder. In other words, you get diagnosed with Hashimoto's, you better quit gluten yesterday. And I mean 100%, not 99%, not being mostly good, but 100%. Because you're asking for huge problems if you don't. You cannot improve in that condition. There's no hope for improvement until, at the very least, you put a stop to your consumption of gluten-containing foods and using personal care products also that contain, you know, wheat proteins.
Right, and that is a subject that many people don't know about. So, do you have any recommendation on how to find that out in a product?
Well, when you read the label, you'll usually see vegetable protein or wheat protein. You know anything wheat, rye, or barley, or spelt, or you know any of these. There are a number of different varieties of wheat that sometimes get put on a label. They're all, you know, equally reactive. And it's, you know, I know that there are people that think that you can go and eat European wheat and that's going to be okay. And that's a myth. Once you've developed an intolerance to gluten, it's all gluten, you know, in all wheat products, not just the newfangled stuff. And the newfangled stuff just advances that problem and it triggers that problem faster.
Because it's been hybridized and
Yeah. And because, you know, they deamidated the gluten and have made it, much more damaging in a way. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that once you've been sensitized to that, it doesn't go away. There is no such thing as healing your gluten intolerance. Now, if you avoid gluten long enough, and I hope you do, you'll eventually start testing negative for gluten antibodies. And that's a great thing. It shows that, you know, because you stop producing antibodies after a while to a food when you stopped eating it for a while. Mm-hmm. That is not a signal that you are healed of your gluten intolerance and that it's okay to go back and start eating it again. All it means is that you're not being exposed to it right now. And that's a good thing. And you want to retest periodically to look at that and make sure that it's not sneaking its way in somewhere. Right?
Right.
So, but it is not a green light to go back and start eating croissants again.
Well, that makes sense.
Right.
Well, I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about fats.
No, fats, you got it.
Fats have gotten a bad rap. I remember I think it was the 80s when the fat-free thing came out and everybody was eating a fat-free diet. And
right.
Give us your take on that and how how you view fats in our diet now.
Well, I actually, you know, fats are easily the most generalized, misunderstood component of our diet. And are absolutely the most unjustly picked on as being a problem in our diets or a problem, you know, to our health. And, you know, the thing is that fat isn't just one thing. Fats are made up of many different things. There are polyunsaturated fats. There are monounsaturated fats. There are saturated fats. And even in those different categories, there are different types. As long as they are naturally occurring, they're okay as long as there's a relative balance. What's problematic are fats that have become rancid, fats that are overly processed, or God forbid, fats that have been partially hydrogenated. You know, in other words, trans fats. And those are never okay. Now, you can go back through the whole, you know, history of how this whole misconception came to be and look at what Ansel Keys did with the 7-country study and all of that. But the fact is that we are actually, that all large mammals are actually designed, it turns out, to get the majority of their caloric intake, from fats. And in fact, most large mammals actually get the majority of their caloric intake from saturated fat. Now, I'm sure you're sort of scratching your head and saying, well, what about a cow? Well, cows actually can get 70 to 80% of their actual caloric intake from butyric acid, which is a short chain saturated fatty acid that is derived from the bacterial fermentation of all the fiber they consume. So cows basically consume what looks like a carbohydrate-based diet, and yet they get very little calories, actual calories, from those carbohydrates. What they get are bacteria to do the digestive work for them, break down the cellulose, and then the bacteria synthesize butyrate, which the cows then absorb as energy substrate. And of course, these same bacteria also produce a lot of nutrients and enzymes and things like that that they also make use of. But so even the herbivores that appear to be vegan in their makeup are not actually obtaining their primary macronutrient intake from carbs. They're actually getting the majority of their calories from fats. And our ape ancestors, even gorillas, get 60 to 70% of their caloric intake from butyrate, butyric acid, from the bacterial fermentation, and they're much larger guts than what we have. They have a much more bacterially based digestive process than we do. Our large intestine is greatly reduced over even our ape ancestors, and our small intestine is greatly expanded, mainly because we have a hydrochloric acid based digestion that is designed to get fat from the diet directly, from the animals that have already manufactured it, in their body tissue. That's how we're meant to get it.
So, and what's the best kind of fat for us to eat?
Well, as long as it is a natural dietary fat, as far as I'm concerned, it's something that we're designed to make use of. Our body needs a variety of them. There is no one type of fatty acid that is the best. And there's a little too much emphasis I think that there's a lot of people are deficient in omega-3s, and yeah, they're great. But you can't be doing omega-3s to the exclusion of other sources of fatty acids. There are, omega-6 fatty acids are essential too. The problem is that we get probably 20 times in the standard American diet, or maybe even double that, than we do omega-3s. In fact, some people get none at all, in any meaningful way. And, that is a terrible imbalance. What you end up with then, are a tendency to, lean your prostaglandin production toward inflammation, toward inflammatory prostaglandins. There needs to be a relative balance. Also, you need a certain amount of saturated fat to make healthy use of the polyunsaturates in your diet. Dietary saturated fat actually serves to protect and transport those polyunsaturates to various places in the body so they can be utilized more effectively. The thing about saturated fats that's kind of cool is that, with all the talk about antioxidants, that saturated fat by its very nature is inherently resistant to oxidation. And so it has a protective value when it comes to the presence of inflammation or the presence of, oxidative processes, because it tends to be resistant to those a little bit. That's why the stuff that coats our lungs and protects our lungs, what's called lung surfactant, is actually made up of a disaturate molecule. Roughly 50% too of the fat in the human brain is made up of saturated fats. It has to be there because it affords a resistance to oxidation. It also gives some structural integrity. If everything is made up of these plant fats, these oils, that makes for very kind of a weak cell wall. Mm-hmm. And what you want is saturated fats, and also, by the way, cholesterol, to give a little bit more integrity and semi-permeability to that cellular membrane so that it can function more appropriately. So saturated fats, animal source fats, have always played an important role in human health. But in particular, the human brain is extremely dependent on dietary fats. Especially the 20 and 22 carbon fatty acids that, you know, docosahexaenoic acid and arachidonic acid, which has also been given a bad rap. But these are both dietary animal source fats. DHA exists in the human diet, has always existed in the human diet in exclusively animal source foods. And yes, I know that there are processes that can extract the DHA from algae, but I've never met anyone with an algae deficiency, and that's not the method of, that's not the form of DHA I would be preferring to get my, that fatty acid from. But, you know, fully, you know, 2 to 5%, of our body mass is our brains. And yet it requires, it ends up using roughly 20 to 30% of our total caloric energy demands. That's a really expensive organ. And of course, fat has more calories per gram on average than either protein or carbohydrates. And the brain is made up of almost pure fat, at least 80% fat by dry weight. And so the brain absolutely has to have a really rich amount of dietary fat in order to feel and function at its best. And it's some of the biggest fans of my book, Primal Body, Primal Mind, are actually in terms of professionals that have sort of latched onto it, I've actually been neurologists. And there's a really significant number of neurologists, some of them very well known, that have contacted me and just said, hey, you know, thumbs up. I actually, you know, there's Dr. David Perlmutter of the Perlmutter Institute let me know that he actually uses a slide of my book in his public lectures. He's a medical neurologist based down in Florida. Great guy too, but anyway.
Wow, that's just really fascinating. And you mentioned cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And that is a subject I think that I would like you to discuss, because many people are on the statin drugs,
right,
to lower their cholesterol. And let us know what you think about that.
Have a opinion about that or anything else? Okay, so you have to understand that cholesterol is an essential component of every single cell in your entire body. Fully 25% of all the cholesterol in the human body is actually found in the brain. We actually manufacture somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 milligrams a day, that, you know, internally, which is several times the amount that are found in our diets. And actually, cholesterol functions like an antioxidant in your body. That doesn't get talked about every day, but it in fact does. Always had significant amounts of cholesterol in the human diet. And in fact, we have ways of regulating our production of cholesterol based on how much cholesterol we are actually consuming in our diets, and also based on other things going on for which cholesterol may be needed. It's basically our body's version of duct tape in some respect. That's one of its functions anyway. That, in other words, it goes, you know, to wherever it happens to be needed to kind of patch up arterial or tissue damage and maintain cellular integrity. And if you take a statin drug that is designed to, stamp out cholesterol, it's the equivalent of getting rid of the firemen that are coming to put out the fire and then blaming them for the fire.
That analogy.
Yeah. If I see, and I've got another one for you. I mean, if you're driving along and the engine light comes on your car dash, are you fixing the problem by unscrewing the light bulb on that engine light? That is what statin drugs effectively do. They do absolutely nothing to improve your natural physiological functioning. If I get a blood chemistry, somebody's blood chemistry, and I'm looking at that and I see what a lot of people might think of as quote unquote elevated cholesterol, oh, it's 250 or something. What that's telling me effectively is that there is something going on in that person's body for which cholesterol is needed. In other words, cholesterol is only at best an intermediate indicator. It's just telling me that we need to basically stop the car, pop open the hood, and take a look at what's happening. And by the way, and at the same time, be happy that cholesterol is there doing its job, because it is there to help. So then the task becomes figuring out what else could possibly be causing this elevation of cholesterol. And I don't ever worry about cholesterol in and of itself. And so, because it's not a villain. It's, you know, your body is trying to do the best that it can with whatever's going on to keep you alive and to compensate for whatever damage you or something in your environment may be doing to it. Cholesterol is an essential part of that. If you stop eating cholesterol and you start trying to dampen it down, your body is, well, if you stop eating cholesterol, your body's going to become a whole, it's going to see it as basically a starvation thing. It's going to see it as a bit of an emergency. And your liver is going to step up the production of an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, which is going to greatly increase your production of cholesterol from other things in your diet, namely carbohydrate. So high carbohydrate diets, even if you're eating very low fat and very low cholesterol, are a sure way of stepping up your actual internal production of cholesterol. By the way, dietary cholesterol and serum cholesterol have so little to do with each other, it's ridiculous.
Can you explain that?
So in the human body, we have anywhere from 100 to 150,000 milligrams of cholesterol occurring throughout our entire body, in all our cells and whatever else. What we see in the bloodstream is only a small representation of that, depending on what's needed there. But there's all kinds of it. When you eat, say, an egg that has maybe 60 milligrams of cholesterol in it or something, how much is that really? And you're only going to absorb a very small percentage of that cholesterol from the egg actually into your, you know, through digestion. You're really only going to absorb a small part of that cholesterol. How much is that really contributing to the total pool? Not by much. It's just a couple of percentage points difference that it could possibly make in terms of the dietary presence of cholesterol. But if you want to dampen your own internal production of cholesterol, then the best way of doing that is by supplying enough in your diet that your body doesn't feel the need to overcompensate by producing it. So high carbohydrate diets, lots of sugar and starch, in other words, I'm not talking about vegetables, you know, fibrous vegetables, but sugar and starch are a great way of increasing your internal production of cholesterol. But also, if you have a depressed thyroid, for instance, you have a thyroid condition, I promise you, you're going to have what looks like elevated cholesterol. There's a compensatory mechanism that goes into play with that, and you have a higher requirement for cholesterol, so it's going to be higher. That doesn't mean that you have now a higher risk for heart disease based on the cholesterol. There may be other things that put you at risk for heart disease, but it's not the cholesterol. If you have an infection of some form, that also can increase that will also likely increase your internal production of cholesterol.
So it sounds like it's more or less like an indicator of something.
That's all it is, an intermediate indicator. And HDL and LDL, by the way, are not cholesterol. What are you saying when you say HDL? HDL is high density lipoprotein. The word cholesterol isn't in there anywhere. Low density lipoprotein or LDL are just basically carrier vehicles. Now LDL is manufactured in the liver and it takes nutrients, it takes cholesterol, but it also takes other things like fat soluble nutrients and other things. And it moves them out to the periphery of your body to do whatever cholesterol needs to do. And then it gets, when it's all spent and it needs to be or damaged or whatever, then you have high density lipoproteins that come and pick that up and bring it back to the liver so that it can be recycled back into LDL again. Now, when you see a higher percentage of HDL to LDL, that tends to associate with, we tend to associate that with a slightly healthier profile. However, these carrier vehicles are just that. They're only really carrier vehicles for cholesterol. There's really only one kind of cholesterol. And they're just different kinds of carrier vehicles marked that are designated to transport it. Now, when I see depressed HDL levels, anything below about 55, I automatically know I'm dealing with a carnivore. In other words, somebody who is eating a very high carbohydrate-based diet. Mm-hmm. That's a given in that situation. That's just kind of obvious. Now, if cholesterol or high density lipoprotein between, say, 55 and 75 is what's considered sort of an optimal functional range, but if it starts getting over 75 or 80, what you may be looking at, unless this person has had it that way all of their lives and is genetically predisposed to having high HDL, but if it suddenly sort of shoots up, this isn't necessarily a cause for celebration. there is an association with excessively high HDL and a nonspecific source of inflammation going on somewhere. I see it a lot with autoimmune disorders, actually. So basically, the presence of HDL past a certain point isn't necessarily a cause for celebration either. But the point isn't, you know, beating HDL down with a sledgehammer. It's, you know, lifting up the hood and figuring out what else is going on and addressing it that way. I'm very foundational and very functional in my thinking. So for me, you know, trying to take cholesterol and pick it apart down to its finest particulates and all the little, the different types of particle sizes and things like that. I kind of don't waste my time with that. I can tell you if you have a higher carbohydrate diet, that's, you know, you're going to be producing smaller, denser forms of lipoprotein that may cause you problems. There's only one really lipoprotein that is potentially that is known to be potentially harmful. That's lipoprotein little A, and that's basically because it gets in there and it jams into the channels that feed that are involved in all the circulation in and out of nutrients and out of waste with waste products in your arteries, and it plugs that up, and then it gets inflamed, and it's a vector for for basically blood vessel inflammation and cardiovascular disease. But there's not a single statin drug in the world that does anything for lipoprotein little A. The only way to get lipoprotein little A down is lower your insulin production, in other words, lower the carbohydrates in your diet, and then lipoprotein little A goes away, and it's a non-issue. So,
it is a big business, though.
$29 billion a year minimum. Mm-hmm. So yes, this is an economic thing. It really has nothing to do with the science. There are meta-analyses now that have been published. The Hunt 2 study, which was published back in I'm trying to remember what year that study came out, but I think it was just in the last 2 years. The Norwegian University of Science and Technology, they looked at 52,087 individuals between the ages of 20 and 74. And basically, they wanted to look at, all this huge number of studies that were trying to figure out whether there was an association between cholesterol and heart disease and risk of stroke and all of that. And once they adjusted for things like age, smoking, blood pressure, and things like that, the researchers found that women with high cholesterol, for instance, that was more than 270 milligrams per deciliter, actually had a 28% lower mortality risk than women with low cholesterol. In other words, what they called low cholesterol was under about 200, which is considered the upper limits of what's acceptable.
Right.
So the risk for heart disease, cardiac arrest, and stroke actually declined as the cholesterol levels rose. The lowest coronary heart disease risk was actually seen between roughly 200 and 270 milligrams per deciliter. Okay. So, you know, and in fact, cholesterol seems to be more of a longevity marker in women than anything else. And I worry way more about somebody who has cholesterol levels that are too low. Anything below 150 and my blood starts to run cold. I'm very worried about people with very low cholesterol. Your risk of mortality from all causes just literally goes through the roof once you start, as your cholesterol levels go lower. And in that Hunt 2 study, there were about 24,000 men. The lowest risk for causes of death in men was actually seen in the 200 to 230 milligram per deciliter range. So what the conclusion that the researchers in that particular meta-analysis study offered was that they said our study provides an updated epidemiological indication of possible errors and the cardiovascular disease risk algorithms of many clinical guidelines. Gee, you think?
Wow.
These are generalizable clinical and public health recommendations regarding the quote-unquote dangers of cholesterol should be revised. This is especially true for women for whom moderately elevated cholesterol by current standards may prove to be not only harmless but even beneficial.
Wow.
I've got
the drug companies don't want that information out.
don't. And the Framingham Heart Study, that's supposedly gold standard. And people with a falling cholesterol level over the first 14 years of that Framingham study, for each 1% milligram per deciliter drop in cholesterol, there was actually an 11% increase in all-cause mortality over the next 18 years. In other words, you know, very simply put, less is anything but more when it comes to cholesterol.
Right.
But, you know, there's not a lot of money to be made, you know, by just saying, well, no, cholesterol's fine, you know. And I mean, it's become this myth, this pervasive myth in medicine that is making right now, I mean, statin drugs are among the top prescribed medications. And there are people that say, well, statins, they're anti-inflammatory. They lower CRP. And that just makes me want to start pulling my hair out of my head. So the thing to understand about C-reactive protein, a lot of people know that that's a really important cardiovascular marker, that CRP is produced by the liver. Statin drugs actually damage the liver. If you have lowered your CRP by taking statin drugs, what you've actually done is damaged your liver to the point where it can't produce CRP. That's how it lowers CRP. One of the very most common side effects, too, of cholesterol medications is what it does to the brain and nervous system of the people that take them. You're much more at risk for developing memory problems and even dementia-like symptoms. Because, again, fully 25% of all the cholesterol in your body is in your brain, and it gosh darn well better be there. Your brain cannot function normally without it. So remember, cholesterol is not your enemy. And if your cholesterol is elevated, that's basically telling you that's the, you know, maybe it's possibly the dashboard, depends on what you call high, but it's potentially the dashboard light coming on and saying, oops, something's going on. Lift up the hood, but don't just unscrew the light bulb and assume that you've fixed the problem.
Right. So let's end with talking quickly about the paleo diet. Give me kind of the Reader's Digest version of how you eat. Give me a typical day for Nora.
For Nora. Well, what I eat, I don't necessarily call, I wouldn't necessarily generalize and say, well, that's the paleo diet, because the paleo diet is a lot of different things to a lot of different people, depending on who you talk to. And what we call the paleo diet today is probably different from what our ancestors would have called the paleo diet, right?
Right.
What are, you know, it's hard to find woolly mammoth burgers anymore.
Right.
and so what we're left with when we look at how our ancestors ate through most of our evolutionary history are certain principles that we can derive from. We know that they had a high percentage of their caloric intake from animal source foods. So we can certainly derive from that. As the climate and the time of year allowed, there were certain plant foods that may have been available to us that we may have also procured for our consumption. Although, again, wild plants tend to be more toxic than our cultivated plants today. So that would have, you know, that's a debatable thing to some degree. Mm-hmm. But okay, I'm actually willing to concede that plant-based foods are maybe more important to us now, the fibrous vegetables and greens, than they ever used to be during our evolutionary past. And my reasoning for that is that there are phytonutrients present in these foods as well as antioxidants that I think have a greater role to play today than they ever used to because of the environment we've created for ourselves.
Correct.
So from that standpoint, nowadays I'm probably eating more vegetables than most vegetarians are. I actually moderate my protein intake. I'm not into more meat is better. I think that there is very little to support the idea that that protein past a certain small amount, just maybe 2 or 3 ounces in the course of a meal, past a certain point, you know, there's a little bit of diminishing returns. There is an optimal level of protein we all require. And if you start exceeding that, your body will start converting the excesses to sugars and using them the same way and storing them, producing insulin, you know, in the presence of that. Which we know to be damaging and lifespan shortening based on new information in human longevity research. But also, you know, you start eating a lot of protein, you start producing a lot of waste products your body has to deal with. And although our body's equipped to deal with that to some degree, you know, why give it the extra burden with everything else we have to process from our daily world? And then finally, also, there are certain metabolic pathways that are more recently discovered. I talk about this a lot in my book. We don't have a lot of time to go into it now, but that we know that when we exceed the amount of protein that we need, and we have to have a certain amount of complete protein. And complete protein really, fully usable complete protein is really only found in animal source foods. To me, that there is a very strong argument to be made for minimizing the amount of sugar and starch in our diets. We are not designed to eat those things. I'm sorry. Not in any significant quantity. You know, the occasional thing is one thing, but we're not designed to use carbohydrates as our primary source of fuel. We're just simply not. And so that's a compromising thing. I don't think we have room for error anymore. We've created a world that is barely livable in many respects. And I think that if we want to optimize our health or even have any semblance of hope of having health, we have to start taking our health seriously, stop using food as a nutrient-devoid source of entertainment, and start really looking at how we can use food to optimize our health. You know, eat to live, but don't live to eat, you know? And so I eat almost no sugar starch at all in my diet. I don't eat bread, pasta, potatoes, rice. If I eat a couple bites of a sweet potato, it's a rare thing. It's not something I typically do. I only usually eat fruits when they're in season, and the only kind of fruit I ever really eat are berries. And so it's coming up to that season. I'll probably have some. You know, if you want to eat a handful of blueberries every day for some of its benefits, then you know, have at it. But, you know, modern day fruit is bred for its size and sweetness, not its nutritional content. What you're mostly eating when you're eating fruit is sugar. Whether it's naturally grown sugar or not, it's still sugar. So, and fructose, which is the primary sugar found in many fruits, is the most damaging kind of sugar there is. It's 20 to 30 times more glycating than glucose. So I don't really eat that. I don't eat, you know, if I eat carrots, they're going to be raw. If you start cooking carrots, then you make them, you basically turn them into a starch, which makes the sugars a lot more, available.
Do you eat eggs?
I am able to eat duck eggs. I do not tolerate, my immune system does not tolerate chicken eggs.
Oh, the casein?
No, there's no casein in eggs.
I thought there were in chicken eggs for some reason.
That's a new one on me, you know.
Somebody told me that, but, you know, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. The casein is the primary protein found in dairy products,
mm-hmm.
you know, milk products.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also quite sensitive to milk products, so I don't do butter or cream even. And in fact, I can't even do ghee, really. Although Pure Indian Foods just came up with a fermented ghee that's supposedly certified casein free. So I need to try that one. Okay. They sent me a sample. I haven't tried it yet.
Well, I thought I had a dairy issue, and then I realized I had a pasteurization issue, so I can do raw.
Okay, well, I can't.
Yeah.
What I would recommend with you, though, is do some testing with Cyrex, because what doing raw may have done is just simply improve the digestibility of casein some. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not immunologically reactive to you. It's just less so.
Oh, I love raw milk cheese.
Well, I do, but, you know, I sort of figured out I can't do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this has been such great information. The one thing that I just want to interject as we're ending here, I think that, you know, it's great to cut out things out of your diet that are going to create a problem for you, but there's got to be an enjoyment of life. And I think that, you know, if there are certain things that you enjoy, won't that balance it out at some point? And I'm not saying, you know, okay, so I enjoy pasta, I'm going to go eat it, you know, and if I basically don't eat gluten, anything with gluten, but, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, what I think about that is that I love to eat, and I actually, the food that I eat is so enjoyable to me. You know, I don't eat anything that I don't enjoy eating.
Right.
But there are a lot of things that I know it's just simply not worth it to me to indulge in, because
right.
There's no room for error. And if your enjoyment of life is predicated on food indulgences, then I think a person might need to adjust their priorities a little bit. That there are a lot of ways of enjoying life, and that doesn't necessarily mean that food needs to be your primary source of entertainment.
I agree. I hear what you're saying.
You know, there are a lot of ways of enjoying the food that you eat without compromising your health.
Right. And again, I think it's about balance.
What do you mean by balance?
It's about balance. I mean, as far as enjoyment of life, I mean, if you're over obsessed with food, your life is out of balance.
You don't have to be obsessed. You just have to be informed and make choices that are appropriate for bettering your health. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, for people that say, well, everything in moderation or 80-20 or 90-10, I mean, really, how much metabolic chaos, how much inflammation, how much immunologic reactivity and risk and compromise to your health do you want to really enjoy in moderation?
Right. And that's a valid point. And that's something I think people have to ponder what you're saying there.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Nora. Nora's book is Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life. And you can probably find that anywhere online on Amazon and everywhere else, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If you, it's better for me if you go to my website, primalbody-primalmind.com, and just sort of click through to the book there. But you can find it in every bookstore, and it's available pretty much everywhere and in every format, including all the ebook formats. I'd also urge people to sign up for my free newsletter. And I've got a ton of free podcasts, lots of free information on my website for people to enjoy.
Okay, and I will post your website on our show page, too, so people can access it that way.
That sounds great, Carol.
Okay, thank you, Nora, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, and this has been great information.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Okay, and thank you, our listeners. We are Food Integrity Now, and we'll be back next week with another great show.